Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 19, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss Title IX, the Department of Energy and Department of Education, and the Department of Justice rule on Title IX. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to have a return guest to Teleforum today, M. Edward Whalen. He's the President of the Ethics and Public Policy Center right here in Washington, D.C. His bio is available in the materials we sent in advance of the call, so that's in my introduction there, so we leave time for more comments and then ultimately questions from the audience. With that, Mr. Whalen, the floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you to those of you on the call. I'm going to talk for 10 or 15 minutes and then open things up to your questions. I want to address the guidance letter that the Department of Justice and Department of Education sent out via something that was jointly signed to basically all school districts in the country a week ago Friday. Let me first, though, put this in the context of the Obama administration's broader transgender agenda, an agenda it's pursuing across the entire alphabet of the federal bureaucracy. The foundational premise of this agenda is that the objective fact of biological sex is some sort of arbitrary fiction assigned at birth, as the phrase that the administration repeatedly uses puts it, and that the purely subjective conception of gender identity is the genuine reality that demands recognition and respect, including the use of wrong pronouns. We thus end up with phrases, as in this example from the New Republic, "She tried to castrate herself by tying off her testicles." That is the world that we are entering into and that the Obama administration is trying to push us into. Okay, let's focus for now on Title IX, though I emphasize that this agenda is being pursued through different statutes, as we'll see when we turn briefly to the North Carolina battle. Title IX is a law enacted in 1972, part of an education amendments law in that year, that for our purposes prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex on the part of colleges and schools that receive federal funds. Now, colleges and schools that receive federal funds are not simply public colleges and schools. Indeed, virtually every college receives federal funds, and a lot of private schools also do through lunch programs and programs for disabled students. So this misreading of Title IX that I'm going to outline has sweeping consequences nationwide for a whole range of schools. In this so-called Dear Colleague letter sent out last Friday, the civil rights officers in DOJ and in the Education Department spelled out the administration's theory. That theory begins with a proposition that Title IX's prohibition on sex discrimination includes a prohibition on discrimination based on a student's gender identity. As I'll discuss, while that proposition is controversial, it's really irrelevant in the context of the bathrooms and showers and other things that are issue here. Second, that letter goes on to say that gender identity refers to an individual's internal sense of gender. So again, under this guidance letter, it's a purely internal sense of gender, need not be manifested in any outward way. Certainly need not involve any medical diagnosis or treatment. Indeed, the departments say that on the very next page, page 2 of the guidance letter, where they say that that they interpret Title IX to require that when a student or the student's parent or guardian notifies the school administration that the student will assert a gender identity that differs from previous representations or records, the school will begin treating the student consistent with the student's gender identity, irrespective, goes on to say, of any medical diagnosis or treatment. Well, what does that mean? Well, among other things, Let's start with bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers. We've heard so much about the so-called bathroom wars, but I think it's important to have in mind that every claim that the administration is making applies equally to locker rooms and showers. And that's made quite clear in this letter where the DOJ and the Education Department say that a school must allow transgender students access to facilities consistent with their gender identity. Well, let's make sure we understand what this means concretely. A boy who says he thinks he's a girl must be allowed to use the girls' showers at the same time that the girls are using the showers. Indeed, precisely because he says he thinks he's a girl, he can't be allowed to use the boys' showers. This applies not only to bathrooms and showers and locker rooms, it also applies, by the way, to sports teams. So that, again, a boy who identifies as a girl must be eligible to take part on sports teams. I think we're going to see this also apply to eligibility for women's scholarships in college. Further, the administration spells out that the same rule applies to dormitories and colleges. A school must allow transgender students to access housing consistent with their gender identity. So this is the interpretation of Title IX that's being advanced. Let me spell out briefly what some of its defects are. They're both substantive separately involve defects of administrative law. On the substance, I'm going to pass quickly by the claim that Title IX's prohibition on discrimination on the basis of sex includes a prohibition on discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Because what I want to emphasize is that in this particular context of bathrooms and showers, we don't have anything that can fairly be called discrimination at all, unless this discrimination is collapsed into some sort of all-purpose epithet for laws that the left doesn't like. And I think I can illustrate this concretely if we consider what discrimination on the basis of gender identity would be. We can understand that in the employment context, if there were discrimination on the basis of gender identity, that would mean that an employer would be taking gender identity into account in deciding whether or not to hire someone. That indeed is what discrimination generally involves, taking a trait into account in making a decision. Well, the very point of single-sex bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers is that gender identity has nothing to do with who is assigned to which bathroom, locker room, and shower. It's all done on the basis of sex, or I guess what we're now are supposed to call biological sex. So it's a very curious thing to argue that that single-sex bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers that make gender identity irrelevant to which facility one is to use somehow discriminate on the basis of gender identity. Indeed, if we were to take this proposition seriously, we would have the end of any sort of sex-segregated facilities, sex-segregated sports teams, sex-segregated dormitories. If, for example, it's discrimination on the basis of gender identity to bar a boy who thinks he's a girl from using the girls' room, then it surely is also discrimination on the basis of gender identity to bar a boy who knows he's a boy from using the girls' room. After all, the only difference between the two boys in this example is their gender identity. What clearer case could there be of discrimination on the basis of gender identity? And again, that same contradiction plays itself out in sports teams and dormitories. There are a whole bunch of other contradictions that the administration's position runs into, all sorts of inconsistencies where you know they won't possibly actually stick to what they're saying. For example, under their position, a girl on a girls' soccer team who announces to her coach that she's decided that she's a guy, you know, has to be kicked off the team. You can be sure that the Obama administration is never going to enforce anything like that. Okay, let me turn briefly to two major defects in administrative law here. This guidance letter is an effort to sidestep the rulemaking obligation that an agency would typically have in imposing interpretive guidance of this sort. Actually, was a very good op-ed by a Yale law professor in the New York Times the other day, making exactly this point. So I think that there's a deep vulnerability there. It's also the case that Title IX is an exercise of Congress's spending clause power. Therefore, any conditions imposed on the states have to be clear on the basis of the statute. Here, no one claims that the statute has this clear meaning. It's at most, the Obama administration claims that it's adopting a permissible meaning. So again, its misreading of Title IX would fail the spending clause restrictions on constructions of statutes. Let me mention a few more things and then go to discussion. The Fourth Circuit had a ruling about a month ago that's been widely misunderstood. This is a case that actually involved a rural Virginia high school where a girl who identifies as male wanted to use the men's room. And the Fourth Circuit panel, in a very confused decision, overturned the district court's denial of the student's request for a preliminary injunction and sent the matter back to the district court. The key thing to understand is that the Fourth Circuit panel never actually reached the question whether Title IX requires that a girl who thinks she's a boy be allowed to use the boys' rooms. It's a real quagmire of confused reasoning. I've written a whole an article on it for National Review that I'm happy to refer folks to, but it never got to that question, and therefore does not stand as circuit precedent for that mistaken proposition. There is the ongoing war against North Carolina. North Carolina's HB2 law. That is, let me just identify what North Carolina's law does and what it doesn't do, because again, I think there's a lot of misrepresentations in the media of this. What North Carolina's law says is that in government offices and public schools, men and women, boys and girls, shall use the when they're dealing with multi-occupant facilities, shall use the restroom that corresponds with their biological sex, restroom, showers, etc. And biological sex, in turn, is defined to mean the sex on the birth certificate. Now, it turns out that in North Carolina, if you undergo a sex change operation, you can have the sex on listed on your birth certificate changed. A point that's already noted. But more to the point, the law doesn't address the private sector at all. And even in the public sector, it allows and I think implicitly encourages the development of single stall facilities that anyone could use, to avoid what we all recognize is the difficult problem that can arise when someone, adopts an appearance that is dramatically at odds with his biology. The Obama administration has brought claims against North Carolina not only under Title IX but also under Title VII. Title VII governs employers, and the claim is that it's discrimination on the basis of sex, not to provide restrooms and other facilities to transgender individuals on the basis of their asserted gender identity. That suffers from the same defects that I've identified with the Title IX claim. And there's also a claim under provisions of the Violence Against Women Act, which again also turns on a provision involving discrimination on the basis of sex. Finally, I'll note that in addition to litigation going on in North Carolina, there's the prospect of litigation nationwide against this guidance letter. The state attorneys general in Oklahoma, Texas, and West Virginia have already sent a letter to the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, making clear their vigorous disagreement with the guidance letter, and any school district or school, for that matter, affected by this guidance letter, I think also clearly has standing at this point to sue to invalidate that letter on substantive and administrative law grounds. So with that, let me hand it back to Dean and move to discussion.
Thank you very much. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Edwin Whalen, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we start with two questions today. Let's take our first call.
Hi, Ed. This is Roger Severino from the Heritage Foundation. One clarification on the Violence Against Women Act, that actually prevents discrimination on basis of sex and gender identity.
Thank you.
It's a little different for that statute, but it does raise an interesting point. What's the point of gender identity in VAWA if sex already means gender identity for Title VII and Title IX? What additional work does the addition of the phrase gender identity in VAWA get you? And I wonder if that actually undercuts their argument a bit that they're actually suing under that statute as well.
Well, thanks for the reminder on that, Roger. Again, I would think the stronger argument is that what we have in the bathroom shower context is clearly not discrimination on the basis of gender identity at all, and that's the cleanest way to dispose of the issue. We really don't even have we don't have discrimination on the basis of sex either. When we have single-sex restrooms, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself recognized this back in 1975, when she stated quite clearly that a system of single-sex restrooms, rather than being far from being discriminatory, recognized the basic privacy interests that the sexes have. So one thing that's curious about the administration's well, one of the many things that's odd about it is the administration has real difficulty explaining how it would be that single-sex facilities are fine in the first place. And again, under its own reading, extended logically, the whole system would collapse even under its transgender-modified system of single-sex facilities.
Yeah, and they actually allow single-sex private universities to remain single-sex, which is baffling if they are mandating a national bathroom policy throughout, yet you can have single-sex admission policies in private universities based on biology, apparently.
Yeah, well, that's one of the inconsistencies that I've pointed out. But to be clear, Title IX has a specific exception for admissions policies for private universities. So the problem isn't so much in the fact that, say, a school like Mount Holyoke chooses to admit both women who think they're men and men who think they're women. What is a problem, though, I think, is that Mount Hill Holyoke will expel under its policies if you have a man who thinks he's a woman who's admitted and then later decides to identify as male, he gets expelled. Whereas a woman who's admitted as a woman and later decides to identify as male is explicitly permitted to stay in under Mount Holyoke's policies. But again, I don't think you'll see the Obama administration rushing to correct that gross injustice. As like any bully, it's trying to pick on its weakest targets and its enemies, or at least not its friends.
We have two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our next call.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. As your discussion with Roger Severino has just pointed out, we've clearly ventured into cloud cuckoo land with all of this when we clearly discriminate based on sex in admissions, in washroom policies, and even which sports teams you can be on, because we have separate teams for men and women, and I don't think there's a coherent answer to that. So let me ask a very simple practical question. How many people are we actually talking about nationwide? Does anybody have anything close to reliable figures on this?
I don't have the numbers on that. I haven't minded. I've seen a number certainly well into the hundreds of thousands. Now, again, a lot may depend on what definition you use. But if it's simply a matter of choosing to identify as a member of the opposite sex, numbers could be very, very high. If it's a matter of those who choose to undergo surgery or mutilation or whatever you want to call it, so-called sex change operations, the numbers would obviously be much lower. But I don't have at my fingertips any numerical estimate. Look, the fact of the matter is that, if there were injustice involved, it would not matter that the numbers were small. What we're talking about, though, is a group of people who have a plight that deserves our sympathy and our compassionate treatment. And we need to figure out in a variety of different contexts just what that compassionate treatment entails. But these are folks who have zero interest in at least if you look at what the Obama administration, the most vocal transgender advocates are saying, zero interest in giving any weight to the privacy and safety interests of anyone else. I spoke already about, he referred certainly to the privacy interests of girls in showers when guys come in, or even guys in showers when girls come in. But there's also the basic safety matter. It's impossible to quantify, but I think it's undeniable in its direction, which is this transgender policy will make it a lot easier for sex predators to go into the opposite sex's bathroom unchallenged. If you dare to challenge someone now, well, you must be some sort of bigot. So the whole cost-benefit analysis of a whole range of ugly crimes would change significantly. Again, I'm not ready to, I'm not able to quantify what that means, but that's an effect that definitely cuts in one direction, and the other side, most people on the other side, deny it in its entirety.
Well, it seems to me that that's exactly why the numbers do matter, because the cost-benefit analysis changes dramatically if we're talking about 100 people versus nationwide versus 100,000 people nationwide. And if our definition of transgender people is broad enough to encompass 100,000 people nationwide, then I think we've simply got to give up on the notion that there are males and females, and let's just have one set of sports teams for everybody, let everybody compete to the level of their ability. Let's have unisex washrooms with private stalls for everybody, and let's have unisex showers with, again, private stalls for everybody, because there would be absolutely no way to police this in any meaningful way that would protect anybody's rights on any side of the controversy. And with that, I relinquish the floor.
Once again, if you'd like to have the floor, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got two calls pending, so let's go to our next caller.
This is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. And, Ed, first of all, I just want to thank you for doing such great work on this. I missed the very first part of your presentation, but I assume that people are aware of the extended treatment you gave this on National Review Online's bench memos and your article that I just finished reading, actually, in National Review, this issue.
Roger, if I could just interject.
First,
thank you for your kind remarks. Secondly, I should add that I have collected a lot of my writings on these matters together, rather than having 17 different bench memos posts for you to look at. A lot of them are gathered on my Ethics and Public Policy website. So if you go to my page on www.eppc.org, if you're interested, you can find a lot of these arguments spelled out in much greater detail there. Thanks, Roger.
Well, sure. And I think if you print them out, it makes a terrific Father's Day gift or Mother's Day gift, whatever agenda you want. The question I wanted to ask is that, one of the great things about what you've done is to identify, the internal contradictions and problems with this approach. And, given that, and given also your knowledge of the you know, judiciary, which is, you know, your other area of expertise. How do you see this playing out in terms of, you know, what the I mean, it does appear that there are going to be legal challenges to it, that there's going to be some pushback in the courts, which is a good thing. How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think the Obama administration is counting on having put enough of its judges in enough places that you know, to give it a chance of winning. So no matter how absurd these arguments are, we can certainly have seen from, I think, some similarly absurd arguments that have prevailed in recent years that that's no guarantee that they won't win. So I really can't predict there, Roger. You know, a lot obviously depends on which judges are drawn in different places. But, you know, I at some level, I think the fact that this is even being presented as a serious question is a testament to societal collapse. you know, in such a society, who knows what the judges might do? I see that you know, there are all sorts of lawyers in distinguished law firms, you know, running to jump on this bandwagon of the latest grand cause. So if it comes to have that totemic significance, who knows?
Well, thanks for cheering me up.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we've got so many people on the call, let me make a quick commercial announcement about our upcoming Teleforum conference calls tomorrow at 2 p.m. At this same number, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the House versus Burwell case, the latest in the Obamacare challenges. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Today, of course, we're talking to Ed Whalen. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take another call.
Hi, this is Peter Sprigg with Family Research Council. I just was going to comment on the earlier question about the numbers. I think the most frequently cited number by the transgender activists is an estimate that was made by the Williams Institute, which is a pro-LGBT think tank at UCLA, and they estimate that 0.3% of the population is transgender, which works out to about 700,000 people nationwide. And I think they tend to use the 700,000 number because it sounds large, whereas 0.3% sounds small. But that's, you know, that's the only number that I've ever heard on how many transgender people there are, and that's based on their self-identification, not based on whether they've had surgery or not.
Thank you, Peter.
We've got one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Before we go to the next caller, maybe I could ask a question, Ed. You know, you mentioned the Administrative Procedure Act, and you mentioned rulemaking and the way this guidance came into being. Was there any fact-gathering here to identify a problem, or is this by the Department of Education or the Department of Justice? Have they issued any reports that support the idea that a national rule is needed here?
I'm certainly not aware of any reports. Their guidance letter refers to inquiries they've received from around the nation, presumably solicited from many of their allies. They've also issued a separate letter that involves, I guess, a sort of best practices that they've gleaned from different places. This issue has clearly arisen in lots of places. And again, if you take the Obama administration's view that boy who thinks he's a girl has a right to use the girls' facilities, restrooms and showers and locker rooms, then I'm sure that that yes, indeed, obstacles or problems have arisen when that's been asserted, and of course, vice versa for girls who think they're boys. Have in mind that the Obama administration and transgender advocates have rejected as completely inadequate and stigmatizing offering a single stall unit for the use of individuals who identify as transgender. Yes, that's permissible. It's permissible to include that as an option, let me be clear, but they insist that the facilities of the opposite sex must be made available to anyone who identifies as transgender. So again, under that understanding of things, I'm sure that that what the administration considers problems have arisen in different places.
We've got five questions pending now, so let's take another call.
This
Hello?
Is Bob in Maine.
Go ahead.
I'm not an attorney, so please be gentle. I've got two things I'd like you to comment on. One, what implication or impact does this have on the Olympics, which I think they do testing to determine whether one is male or female for purposes of competition. Do we boycott them, or what happens there? The other issue is impoundment. Is this not impoundment similar to what happened under Nixon when impoundment was held to be not part of the powers of the president and the funds could not be withheld?
Okay, let me address your two questions as best I can. First, you are right that the International Olympic Committee has some sort of testing to determine whether a man who identifies as female can participate in female sports. That involves, I believe, testing the level of testosterone to make sure it's gotten down to a certain level. Whether that would be a problem for the administration is a little bit unclear because one aspect of the guidance letter that I passed over is this curious sentence under athletics that says that Title IX does not prohibit age-appropriate tailored requirements based on sound, current, and research-based medical knowledge about the impact of the student's participation on the competitive fairness or physical safety of the sport. Now, I have no idea what that means. I do find it curious that that age-appropriate tailored requirements are permitted when it comes to sports teams, but somehow basic concerns of privacy can't be taken into account when it comes to restrooms and showers. On impoundment, no, this would not fall under the same concern. The question in impoundment involves, as I understand it, the president's exercise of a supposed discretionary authority to refuse to spend funds that Congress has authorized. The claim here, it's a faulty claim, but the claim here is that Title IX requires the administration to withhold federal funding from recipients who have failed to comply with the conditions attached to Title IX. So the defect is in the reading of what those conditions are, but not a broader impoundment concern.
Thank you.
Let's move right along to the next caller.
Hi, Ed. This is Teresa Collette in Minnesota. We have a public school fight going on in this area. And I understand that we don't have any firm data other than the Williams Institute's estimate on the number of people impacted. Has there been, to your knowledge, any studies on the economic impact on compliance where people are opting, as one of the other commenters suggested, that we simply go to all individual stalls, both for showers, because I cannot imagine the public school funding going to reconstitute our bathrooms, you know, instead of more critical educational needs. Do you know of any numbers on this stuff?
I haven't seen numbers, but, you know, the retrofitting involved would be incredibly expensive. Among other things, you just have much reduced capacity, you know, per square foot. So I don't think that is a very meaningful option. You know, it may be something that could, you know, guide building in the future. But again, I don't think the answer. I'm all for some sort of reasonable accommodation that apply to these folks. I don't think the answer leads where where David has suggested it leads. I don't think it leads to having an entire system of single stall units for toilets and showers. I think rather it leads to making sure that you have your basic system of boys and girls rooms and have some separate facilities available to those who need them. And you know, the concerns that is somehow stigmatizing, I just don't think that is that does not strike me as a compelling concern.
I agree. I'm just was hoping that you could give me a source, because I think at least when we're talking to policymakers, saying that the only option that is, you know, presented by this is this sort of dramatic expenditure that's absurd, they will listen to that in a way and not hear bias that you hear.
I don't have those numbers. Someone else will need to
know
those. But I want to emphasize that another option is just to decline the federal funds. I understand that for many school districts, it's a relatively small percentage of funding that's involved. Again, it's usually just for school lunches or for programs for disabled kids. Very important things. I don't mean to diminish those, but the federal government is going to use that as a lever to try to impose its agenda. Maybe the only answer is to say, no, thank you, federal government. We'll do without your funds.
Okay, thank you.
You're also going to be facing the same threat from the states. And again, this is an agenda that is not limited to the schools. The overall agenda is to have this in every restaurant, every health club, every restroom or shower facility in the country.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And let me just interject here quickly. It's striking me for the first time. I didn't realize that the third bathroom was not an option in the eyes of the federal government. That is, this you could have a third sort of gender neutral bathroom that anybody could use. So it seems like
let me just be clear on that. It's
please.
Okay to have something like that,
yes.
But it's not a solution. It's not a solution to the problem, and the Obama administration has firmly rejected that in time after time, and the EEOC specifically has said that's not acceptable, and so yes, that's not an option.
So if we take the case of a boy who identifies as a girl in high school, the harm to be avoided is not that he's to be he's able to get away from the boys who might harass him. The harm includes not being included affirmatively, not being included with the girls.
Yes, the insistence here is that everyone embrace this foundational transgender premise that a boy who thinks he's a girl is really a girl,
right.
And the Obama administration has said said pretty much exactly that in those terms. The EEOC has said that never mind the irrelevant matter of genitalia, never mind physical appearance. A boy who says he's a girl is a girl. And if you don't accept that proposition, you are a hateful bigot.
We've got four people pending here with questions, so let's move right along.
Hi, my name is John Hansen from the Boston chapter. I'm curious if you have any insight, or perhaps it falls into the category of speculation, as to the timing of this guidance. We're at the cusp of a national election where culture and public policy may well be a factor, and yet this administration, who I think would always weigh political considerations, nonetheless released this, as I say, at the cusp of a national election. Any thought on that?
Sure. I'll throw out a couple thoughts, and it certainly is in the realm of speculation. But look, you have these civil rights offices throughout the administration staffed with hardcore activists on this who are eager to get things done before the Obama administration ends. So there's a certain time urgency that comes into play. Secondly, I think they're confident that they can misrepresent the Fourth Circuit ruling from last month and leverage that in their favor. And third, I think that Donald Trump's own comments initially about opposed to the North Carolina law gave them confidence that they could handle whatever political fallout there is from this. I'd have to think fourth that the dismal prospects of getting a a good conservative president elected this November also embolden them. So I think those factors combine to say, you know, if not now, when? Better push it.
Thank you.
Let's move right to our next caller.
Hi, this is Nathan from Los Angeles. So I thought your comments were really fantastic, particularly that you were able to bring in some of the broader issues that are in play beyond just bathrooms. I think most of the things I've read really just deal with the aspect of bathrooms, where I think your points were really quite excellent. This really extends far beyond that. So I had a couple of questions for you. And the one is there a glass half full aspect to this in the sense that it raises a lot of issues that I think are of a lot of import to people listening on this call, you know, issues of federalism, issues of the federal government's overreach or the president's overreach, issues of reinterpreting in what seems like a completely preposterous way a 50-year-old statute, and in an area that will have an impact on virtually everyone's life in the country. So I wonder, my first question is, do you see this as an issue that will cut through to the general populace issues that are of great import to the federalist society, like federalism and administrative overreach, and why is the federal government involved with bathroom policy at all? Why should people in California be involved, care at all about what the bathroom policy of North Carolina is, and vice versa? So that's my first question. My second question, and I'm not an expert in administrative law, but I assume because this is just a letter, there's no deference given as a legal matter to the view taken in the guidance letter. And then my third question is, and I'm a lawyer, and I'm really struggling to come up with any colorable justification for rereading, 50-year-old statute in this way. So just playing the devil's advocate, what is the strongest argument on the other side?
Okay, three questions. Let me try to take those quickly. First, I confess I'm not generally a glass half full type of guy. You have a hopeful take here that this might reawaken folks to what's going on. I hope you're right. I wouldn't predict that, but we'll see. I do think that you nicely make the point, or at least imply, that this really is something where localized decision making can work best. I mean, an employer can figure out what works in his workplace. A restaurant can decide what it wants to do, including obviously there are plenty of places that have single unit stalls that works just fine. Second question, yes, there would be no Chevron deference at all to a guidance letter like this. I think that's clear. It certainly is clear that the informal letter that the Obama administration relied on in the Fourth Circuit case, had the court actually reached the question of what Title IX means, would not have gotten received any deference on that question. And I'm sorry, I'm misreading my notes on your third question.
What's the best argument on the other side?
The best argument on the other side. Well, look, I think there's sufficient muddle on the threshold question of, given some previous court rulings just what exactly discrimination on the basis of sex means. So there's one part of their argument, the part that I passed over because I thought it ultimately insignificant, that is a serious one under existing precedents, and things need to be sorted out. Now, the fact of the matter is that the federal courts of appeals have uniformly ruled that discrimination on the basis of sex does not include discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So it's rather extraordinary now that we're supposed to read the same cases the other side cites as somehow establishing the proposition that there definitely is a prohibition on discrimination on the basis of gender identity. That said, there are things involving gender identity that come into play under existing doctrines about sex stereotypes and so on. I'd have to leave it to someone more expert in Title VII to run through some of those distinctions. But my broader point is, two points. First, I don't think that gets you to the proposition that there is a general ban on discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And more fundamentally, even if there were, this isn't discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. This is differentiating on the basis of sex, of biological sex. And it's the Obama administration that wants to have discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Pardon me if I said sexual orientation before, I meant gender identity. It wants to discriminate in favor of gender identity, have gender identity trump biological sex. It's the one that's seeking to discriminate on that basis.
If I may ask just a follow-up question on the last point, so, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is not my area, but isn't the operative legal question what the, you know, what the word sex means? And I assume the Civil Rights Act or Title IX of the Civil Rights Act is not really the question. And whatever the Supreme Court may have said in Obergefell or other constitutional cases should have no bearing upon it, because the question ought to be, what did Congress think that word meant when it passed the law?
Well, that's right. That's a statutory question. The cases the other side cites are typically not, I mean, not, it's not Obergefell. It's other cases involving Title VII, a case called Price Waterhouse v. Hopkins from, I'm confused now, sometime in the 80s, a case called Oncale that Justice Scalia wrote that they misrepresent as standing for a much broader proposition than it stands for. But there's this claim that anything that is said to somehow relate to the word sex must be brought within the scope of Title VII, which I don't think is what the cases fairly stand for. But again, more importantly, even if they do, it doesn't help them in this context.
Thank you.
We've got about almost 15 minutes, 12 minutes or so. Three questions pending. Let's move right along. Go ahead, caller. You might have your own telephone on mute. If that's the case, you need to come off mute. Okay. Looks like we have two questions pending. If that caller wants to ring back in with a question, I think they figured out the mute button. Did that work out? Yeah, we can hear you.
We hear you.
Great. Sorry. This is Ben Johnson in New Jersey. So I had a couple of questions. So it seems first I'd take a swing at the best possible argument, which would be that on the other side would be that those who gender identify as a man are discriminated against based on their sex, whether they are or not. So people that gender identify as a man can only go into the men's room if they are in fact a man, and if they are biologically a woman, preventing them from doing that would be discrimination based on sex. I don't think it's a particularly good argument, but I think it's the best one that you could come up with. But my questions are more related to the colleges. So the last time the Department of Education sent out a Dear Colleague letter, it was to eviscerate due process at the collegiate level. And I'm wondering what in this letter stops the same type of requirements from dealing with federal loans to colleges and universities who don't get on board with the same agenda. Is it by its own terms, it could be removed in a subsequent guidance letter to colleges and universities? And insofar, both the college and the lower levels, where does FERPA stand in here? So imagine an unscrupulous college wants to bring back some men's sports, you know, Olympic sports and such. So they just kind of say that several of our football players, who we can't tell you who because of FERPA, actually now gender identify as female. So that's a whole bunch of scholarships that under Title IX we've awarded to women. Is there anything that, I mean, how's this going to, I mean, what a tangled web and all, but how would, presumably it would be a violation of FERPA to out a student as transgender in some sense, right?
Well, let me try to answer that. First, this Title IX guidance does apply fully to all colleges that receive federal funds. So, and it actually sets up a clash, I think, with the whole set of Title IX guidance on avoiding harassing environments. You'd think that there would be many women who would find it harassing to have guys in their showers, so you have the two arms of the federal bureaucracy seemingly at war with each other. I'm not familiar with the privacy question you ask, but it's clear under this letter that if a guy identifies as female, he is generally eligible to take part in the women's sports teams. Now, again, there's that sentence I read that is incomprehensible that seems designed to preserve some wiggle room to deny that in some way. you know, how it is that they can carve out an exception to their reading of Title IX, I don't understand. I mean, they seem to think they can, you know, jerry-rig this to achieve whatever results they want, irrespective of consistency.
I'm sorry, just to follow up, you had said previously that, you know, one thing we could do is just our schools could just not take federal funds, which in the case of K through 12 education may mean missing out on free lunch programs or something like that. But in the context of universities, that means essentially shutting down the doors, right? Because if you can't get tuition money, you can't have school.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Obviously, there are some. There's a handful of colleges that have avoided the strings of federal financing successfully for quite some time now. But most have made themselves heavily dependent on it. I hadn't even focused on the tuition loan aspect of it that you're talking about. So yeah, that would be a significant problem, I would think, for them.
Okay.
Well, maybe that's the upside. Maybe the glass half full is most of the universities in the country closed down.
Well, it's a Baylor graduate. I would hate to see that happen. So.
Okay.
Two questions pending. Let's hear from another caller now.
Yes, hi, it's David Emerson, a Federalist member here in Berkeley, California. Nice presentation, Ed. I can only hope that some of what you've thought and said will make it out into the general public to inform this discussion. Since we're running close to the end of our allotted time, I'll just limit myself to one brief question. And that is just, the thing is that when it comes to a gender identity, I mean, how do you know? Assuming that a person, you know, internally believes they have a gender identity, how is a person who is in a bathroom going to have any sense of whether someone is inappropriately in there or appropriately with them? And even more so in the case of someone who has a policing authority, who may have responsibility for a university or, for example, to make sure that people go into the right restrooms, and they have legal liability if they you know, turn a blind eye to that. How does anyone know what is in the mind of a person when they're walking into a bathroom?
It's a great question, and the answer is you can't know. Now, the transgender advocates that I've dealt with will say, well, most of the time, you know, most transgender people try to dress in a way and do other things in a way to make themselves appear the opposite sex. Well, the very proposition that most do clearly implies that some don't. And the whole, I forget what they call it, the whole transition process is a process that, first of all, you don't need to undertake in order to be deemed transgender under the Obama administration's guidance. Secondly, even if you do undertake it, it clearly has a beginning point where you're not going to be distinguishable from others. So, no, I think this is exactly how it opens the door to predators and mischief makers. For that matter, who's going to be tempted now? I mean, one would have thought, you know, a year ago or 5 years ago, that it would be a manly thing for anyone to confront someone who was going on into the wrong restroom and say, you know, what are you doing this? You know, standing up for the vulnerable. But now, if you do that, no, you're a bigot against transgender individuals, and who's going to risk that sort of stigma?
We've got two questions pending, so let's see if we can get to these final two questions.
My name is Andrew Warshaw from Lansing, Michigan. My question is, has the Justice Department spoken on federal sentencing guidelines? Can a gender identity woman who identifies as a man or vice versa be sentenced to a penitentiary for that gender?
I think I heard you. Your voice was in and out a little bit, but the question, I think the question is basically of assigning prisoners to federal prisons. This is an interesting fact that the DOJ's prison regulations that I believe apply to federal prisons, but certainly apply to state prisons that receive federal funding, require individualized consideration of what's best for individuals who identify as transgender. In other words, the federal government isn't abiding by the same standard, the same one-size-fits-all blanket, unreflective standard that it's trying to impose on school districts throughout the country. The same standard that it's actually trying to impose via this Violence Against Women Act on North Carolina's prisons themselves. So you have one arm of the Department of Justice telling North Carolina's prisons that they can't they can't have some automatic rule of sending a man who thinks he's a woman to a woman's prison or vice versa, that individualized consideration is needed. We need to sort through all the circumstances. And then you have this other arm of DOJ administering the Violence Against Women Act, saying in all your properties that receive funds under the Violence Against Women Act, you need to comply with this rule that requires that you treat men who think they're women as women. So the Department of Justice is itself contradictory on this basic point. Again, one of the many, many, many contradictions and absurdities that pervade this ill-considered policy driven by ideologues.
We might be reaching a record here for Teleform in terms of number of questions asked. We still, as if by magic, have two questions pending, so let's take another call.
Yeah, Rod Sullivan in Jacksonville here. I just had a quick question. Do you know if GG versus Gloucester County School Board has been taken up on a petition for cert? And in light of the fact that it's a question of first impression, what do you think the likelihood is that the Supreme Court will take it up in light of the fact there's no conflict and no prior precedent?
Yeah, I believe a petition for rehearing en banc has been filed. But have in mind that the posture of the case is interlocutory, by which I mean to say that what the district court did was deny a preliminary injunction to GG. And what the Court of Appeals majority said is the basis upon which you denied the preliminary injunction was not a sound basis. We're going to send this back to you for you to consider it more. And exactly what the district court is supposed to decide on remand, I think the majority doesn't understand what it's doing, but I think it's entirely open to the district court on remand to say, oh, well, this rule that I relied on before, I'm now told, doesn't say what it says. I'm now going to look at what Title IX says, and I see that Title IX clearly allows what the high school is doing by excluding this girl who thinks she's a boy from the boys' restrooms, and on that basis, I'll deny the preliminary injunction. So I also think at this point, obviously the Supreme Court's in pretty bad shape generally, and who knows if and when it'll get better. But this is not a case that I think the court would be likely to grant again, especially in this interlocutory posture, especially given that you could have 10 very good lawyers spending a couple hours looking at the opinion and having 10 different views as to what it means. I think I finally figured it out, but some of you might read it and think I'm wrong. But I encourage you, if you're interested, again, it's available on my institution's website, but also on NRO. Look for my article, please, on that. That GG v. Gloucester ruling.
Well, I didn't get through all 69 pages, but I'll try. Thanks.
My article is shorter than that.
Yeah. That website, again, is www.eppc.org. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Looks like we have a final question here.
Hi, this is Brittany from Chicago. I actually used to work at the U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, who has promulgated this Dear Colleague letter. And I just wanted to follow up on a couple points that other people had raised earlier, for example, regarding the timing. I know even when I worked there about 2 years ago, there were conversations about these kind of issues going on. And even at that time, you know, we were receiving complaints from people who alleged to be transgender and we're not allowed to use certain bathrooms or locker rooms. So these sort of issues have been percolating for a while. I don't know why they chose this time to promulgate the Dear Colleague letter, but I know that the conversation has been ongoing for a period of time. And it seems to me that it's part of not only this bigger transgender agenda, but also a bigger agenda regarding Title IX. As somebody else pointed out earlier, I see a connection between this Dear Colleague letter and the April 2011 Dear Colleague letter regarding sexual assault on college campuses and this extremely broad, expansive reading of Title IX that just defies the plain text itself. And I think that the administration has been very successful at wielding Title IX in the sexual assault context and is now moving on to other ways that they can use it. Another thing I wanted to point out is we've been discussing possible revocation of federal funding. As far as I know, OCR has never actually followed through on this threat to revoke anyone's funding, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't. And I think there's conversation now about exploring other ways that they can wield this power, because I think they're seeing that it might be a little unreasonable to completely withhold federal funding. So I've heard discussions about other sorts of punishments, like partial revocation of funding, which they might not be as hesitant to use. And one last point I wanted to make to follow up on the discussion about this funding, I think you had mentioned that some schools, K-12, for example, could just choose not to accept the federal funding. And I also used to be a teacher before law school and worked in a Title I school. And without federal funding, that school would absolutely have to shut down. And there are many, many schools across the country that would not be able to function. So in this way, it sort of highlights the liberal hypocrisy to me, because it would be schools that are low income that would not be able to function without this Title I funding, whereas other schools who are wealthier would be able to do that. So it would put students at greater security risk of being sexually assaulted in bathrooms. It would eviscerate their privacy rights sheerly based on their socioeconomic status, which I think liberals claim to really be devoted to helping low-income individuals, and I think this highlights the hypocrisy of their viewpoint.
Well, thank you for all those excellent points. Let me ask you just one question, if I may, pardon my ignorance, but I gather from what you say that so-called Title I schools are those that receive special federal funding because they're poorer schools. Is that right?
Yes. So they have a certain threshold of students who are free and reduced lunch. So the school I worked at was 99% of the students were on free or reduced lunch. And so they receive a lot of federal funding. We also had 20% of our students had disabilities, which is also something that requires a lot of funding to serve those students.
Thank you.
Well, we've exhausted the audience's questions, Ed Whalen. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You certainly answered a lot of questions in addition to making some great opening remarks. So thank you for joining us. To the audience, thank you as well for dialing in, quite a few of you, and thank you for your questions. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about House versus Burwell. It's an update on the latest challenge to the Obamacare case. If you've lost track of the Obamacare litigation, it's essential that you join us. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.